I should use this mic. Yeah. Okay.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is the final session of the security minicom for LCA 2005. And right up next, we've got Simon Holmes talking about SSL and TLS. Thank you.
Okay. First up, I'd just like to say this presentation is actually available on my website. I wonder how I can put the URL up, actually. I thought it was actually on the slide, but I can see it's not. sorry about that. So if you go to that URL, you can get a much longer version of this presentation because you don't have much time, and even less now, I just wasted a few minutes there. What this presentation is about is I did quite a lot of work a little while ago on SSL and TLS at the implementation level. I actually implemented a whole bunch of the protocol. Unfortunately, it hasn't been released. But in the course of that, I found myself explaining the same things about TLS and SSL over lunch or dinner to many different people. So I thought it might be valuable to make a presentation and get that out there. If you're familiar with the way the SSL and TLS protocols work, and by that mean I mean the internals of it, this is going to be pretty boring. But for everyone else, hopefully it'll be quite interesting. So I'm going to basically divide it into two sections. Firstly, give a kind of high-level overview, and then I'm going to try and dig into the actual format of the packets and things like that. And I'm hoping I can cover that in an hour. We'll see how we go. So SSL and TLS basically are a way of providing a secure communication channel over an otherwise insecure network. So this basically means that there's no end-to-end control, and the internet is pretty common, a pretty good example of this. It also, it's usually this communication is done on a fairly ad hoc basis. So you imagine yourself maybe connecting via HTTPS to your bank or something like this. You don't actually have a prearranged trust arrangement. You don't actually know what their certificate is. And even if you do, they have no idea who you are. So it's an ad hoc kind of a relationship. And there's basically two key things that you need to address to do this successfully. Firstly, you need to what I'd call data integrity. So this basically means no one's sniffing your packets, and if they are, they can't read what's inside. It also means that if they sniff the packets, they can't change what's inside without you being aware of that. And they also can't sort of throw away packets and sort of give you partial information or terminate the connection before you get the really good stuff. So they can't tamper with the information. They can't see it, and they can't tamper with it. And the other point, the other important point which is often missed is endpoint verification. So this means that when you connect to your bank's website, you should be thinking about whether or not that website is actually run by your bank, because otherwise you're about to put your sensitive password into, well, who knows whose hands. So these are the two issues. Firstly, making sure the data is not interfered with, and second, making sure it actually goes to who you expected. So there's a couple of different ways you can attack the integrity of the data. Firstly, you can view what's inside it. You could try and modify it. Or you could try and truncate it. And the way that TLS and SSL address this kind of problem is through a variety of techniques. They use asymmetric encryption. The most common example is RSA. They use symmetric encryption, which is things like DES and AES. And they use things called message access code. The message access code is like a signature that goes on to the end of the message, and it incorporates not only the message itself, but a secret key that's only known by both parties. And so without the secret key, it's very difficult to fake the message because you can't recreate a correct message code without knowing the secret. Okay, so I'm going to just look a little bit into each of those three little bits of technology. So asymmetric encryption is a fairly simple idea. You have two keys, private key which you keep to yourself, and a public key that you give to anyone. And the public key can be used to verify signatures, so when you send a signed piece of data, they can verify it. And the public key is also used for encryption, which means that the holder of the private key is the only person who can decrypt the data. It's fairly straightforward. The main problem with it is it's actually quite slow, so you don't want to be using this for encrypting lots and lots of data. It's not a workable solution. So The reason that it's slow is it basically relies on factoring two primes, and to make it sufficiently difficult for it to be attacked, you want these primes to be very long, and just working with long primes takes a long time, so that's why it's slow. So the way we want to make use of it, of this, because it allows us to do the ad hoc arrangement. We don't have to pre-arrange keys. So what we do is we do use a slow public key encryption to negotiate a key which is used for much faster private key encryption algorithms. So private key encryption, the same key is used for encryption and decryption. The key is typically a lot shorter, and therefore the performance is much greater. And this is what, once the handshake is over, so once you're actually transferring data between the application, different applications, so for instance your web browser and the web server, it's symmetric encryption that is doing the work to keep your data secret. Some pretty common examples of this are DES, its successor DES 3, and its successor AES. Another common example is RC4, which is interestingly the only commonly used stream cipher. All the other ones are block ciphers. And I'll get onto why that matters in a little bit. Well, I'll get onto it now. So obviously, if you have a block-based cipher, that means that it takes a certain amount of input, say for instance 64 bytes, something like this, and you encrypt it and you get 64 bytes out again. Okay, fine. What if I only have 63 bytes, or what if I have 1,000 bytes? Well, obviously you need to divide it up into blocks. Most of the encryption algorithms that SSL uses require this. In fact, they all require it except for RC4. So how do we do the blocking? Well, a naive and obvious approach is to just to divide the data up into the block size chunks. Add a pad at the end if you need it, and encrypt and decrypt them. Pretty straightforward. The main problem with this approach is that if you have the same plain text repeated within a stream, or have the same ciphertext. So this basically makes it easier for any would-be attacker to analyze the data and perhaps get your key and therefore the data out. So that's not so good. Fortunately, it's a fairly simple way to fix this. So what do? Before we encrypt the plain text, we XOR it with a ciphertext of the previous message. Obviously, there's no ciphertext for the very first message, so you use a pre-generated text which you're going to use for this XORing. In the case of SSL and TLS, this initialization vector is part of the secret key that's negotiated during the handshake. So it is itself not a publicly available piece of information. And then we encrypt the data, so once we've done this XOR. And what this means is essentially the ciphertext for one blocks depends on not only its plain text, but something relating to the previous block and so on. So the length of the use of that key, which is usually the length of the connection. So in this way, even if the plain text repeats, the ciphertext won't repeat. And this makes it a lot more difficult to try and attack what's going on inside. And this is the method that is used, I think, by all of the cipher suites in SSL. Okay, so the message access code is the third and last little thing I want to talk about right now. Message access code is kind of like a hash. It's actually a nested hash, so basically you run something like MD5 or SHA1 twice, and inside it you include a secret key. And the idea is if you don't have the secret key, it's very difficult to reproduce this MAC, which means if you can't modify the message because the MAC won't match anymore. So it basically protects your messages from being tampered with, even if they're not encrypted. So even if the other party can see what's going on inside, they can't change it. So that's what the MAC is. It's quite important. Okay, so that wraps up the securing your data, making sure no one's peeking inside it and tampering with it. I just want to talk a little bit about how to make sure your data is actually going to the right point, which is quite important. So it is very, I mean, the obvious attack here is the one I mentioned earlier, where someone sets up a bogus bank site and you connect to it. Now, unless they've stolen the bank's certificate, which is quite unlikely, if you did this kind of verification of the certificate, then it would be obvious to you, not necessarily from looking at the website, but from looking at the security, looking at at their certificate, that they, in fact, are not the bank. So how does this work? I mean, it's fairly straightforward. Usually it's done using an RSA certificate. The RSA certificate is typically signed by some sort of trusted party, like, say, VeriSign. I don't know who trusts them, but it's kind of an awkward position because the certificate authorities, the people who sign these keys and say, hey, yeah, this is okay, the fact that basically their key gets shipped with their browser, so it's a little bit, you know, hey, basically they get put in a fairly powerful situation, sort of unfairly powerful, but that's the way it works. So the idea is, if you trust VeriSign and there's a certificate signed by VeriSign, then you trust that certificate. You can also set up your own certificate authority. So say you have, you know, a group of friends or a company-wide infrastructure rolling out. You can do that internally as long as you insert the certificate for the signing party into the browser or whatever software you're using. So then it can easily say, yes, this was definitely signed by this certificate authority that you implicitly trust because you told me to trust it, basically. SSL also supports client authentication. So usually it's just the server you authenticate. But the server can actually request for client authentication, in which case, in the case of RSA, it just sends a certificate. And again, it should be signed. Actually, when the server sends the request for the certificate, it actually lists which type of certificates are okay and also which certificate authorities it's prepared to accept certificates from. So I never really use this much myself. I guess it's most useful when you're setting up some sort of corporate authentication trust structure and you want to actually verify the clients and you issue them all with keys that you've signed with your certificate authority, this kind of thing. It's also possible to do completely anonymous communication. So this means the data may or may not be encrypted, but there's no verification of the endpoints, which means it is very susceptible to man-in-the-middle type attack, the one that I've described a few times where someone sets up a bogus website. The anonymous thing implies, that there's nothing to stop anyone from doing that. It's also not very commonly used. So. Okay, so that kind of wraps up the more high-level section of my presentation. I'm now going to delve into some more details. I think this is quite interesting to understand how the protocol works, and from that you can understand, you know, how different features work and this kind of thing. So firstly, the different versions of SSL. Let's get this out of the way. SSL v1 doesn't exist. SSL v2 was the first one out of the bag. It was released in 1994, I think. But it turned out to have some fairly significant problems. Scarily, most web browsers that I've checked still enable it by default, even though you shouldn't really be using it anymore. It's not that it's insecure, it's just not as secure as its successors, and therefore there's not really any good reason to be using it. So then came SSL v3, which basically fixed all the problems in SSL v2. And then that got turned into TLS v1 as an IETF standard. TLS v1 and SSL v3 are very similar. And except for one or two messages, it's basically the same thing. And that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about SSL v2 because it's actually quite different. These two, SSL v3 and TLS v1, they're like brothers. TLS v1 is based on SSL v3. They just fixed a few minor problems. So what did they fix? They changed the MAC. The MAC is, after SSL v3 was finalized, HMAC became a standard. And so that was used with TLS v1. There's not really been any good analysis on whether in the SSL 3 MAC is broken, but it was an earlier version of HMAC, and it's kind of thought that HMAC probably is better, although no one's really quite sure why. But anyway, it's not a big deal. It's just an implementation deal. Really, it's just a matter of implementing both of them and using the right one at the right time. TLS v1 mandates the use of Diffie-Hellman and DSS. So basically, if you're going to be TLS compliant, you must have these particular cipher suites. This is basically because at the time TLS was being finalized, the RSA patent was still in force. And so even though at that time and subsequent RSA is by far the most common choice, they didn't want to mandate something that was RSA that had this patent problem. The patent since subsequently expired, so it's kind of a little bit of a legacy, really. I'm not going to talk about Diffie-Hellman much either, because I believe that RSA is what most people use, and it's also a little bit easier to understand, I think. Oh, and they also changed the way the master secret is. I'll explain this a little bit when I get to the handshake in a moment, but the master secret is formed by both sides using information they exchange. The master secret gets turned into the keying material, and the keying material gets divided up into the private keys you need for symmetric encryption, the initialization vector for the blocking, and something else that escapes me at this point. But it's the basis of the cryptographic material. So the record layer, SSL and TLS is kind of a very layered protocol, so it usually sits on top of something like TCP, and in fact it has to be a reliable protocol, so it can't work on something like UDP. And then on top of that you have its record layer, and then inside the records, or on top of the records, you have the messages. And then the messages actually have the data themselves inside it, and then that's what gets passed to your application. So at the bottom you have the record layer. It just encapsulates the data. This is the unit that is encrypted, basically. As it says there, you can have up to 2 to the power of 14 bytes of data. In reality, it's usually a lot shorter because you're trying to keep things sort of lined up with the MTUs that's being used. It may contain multiple messages as long as they're the same type, or it can hold partial messages. So a little bit the way TCP, when you send data out on TCP, you might get multiple writes in one read, or you might get partial writes. So how does it look? Okay, it has a 5-byte header, which has the version of the protocol, the number of bytes, and the content type, which is the type of message. There's 4 different types. After that, you have the compressed message data, and then finally the MAC, the message access code. With compression methods, it's sort of in the specification everywhere, but it's not used because pretty much every compression algorithm has some sort of patent hanging over it, so they didn't standardize one. And because it's not standardized, you can't really use it because it's not interoperable. So there's basically no compression. They did the standardized one, which is null, so don't do anything. So when we say compressed message data, it's almost certainly not compressed. But as far as TLS, it's compressed because it's compressed as much as it ever will be. Okay, so at the end of all this, we've got a pad because we have to make it the same length as the block, so the blocking factor of the block cipher we're using. The pad's pretty straightforward. We work out how many bytes we need to round ourselves up to the appropriate length, and then we basically subtract 1 from that. So say we need 5 bytes. Then the pad length becomes 4, and this byte here is set to 4, and then actually all of these bytes are set to 4 as well. So you actually have 4, the number 4, repeated 5 times. it's a bit weird, but it doesn't matter. It can also be any length as long as the blocking factor is satisfied and it's not more than 255 bytes. So this allows the implementation a bit of flexibility. If you want to, say you have a lot of records of the same length, maybe quite short, and you want to, for some reason, make them longer and shorter to maybe confuse the attacker a little bit, you can do this because you can vary the length of the pad. Okay, so inside the record, the record layer is pretty simple, that's it. It's only one type, that's it. So inside the record is the messages. There's four different types of messages. The handshake, which is used for negotiating parameters for the session, usually at the beginning. The change cipher suite, which is, it's kind of like a really special handshake message, which says, okay, everything from now uses the parameters we've just negotiated. So in the case of a typical connection, that means let's start using encryption from now. There's alert messages, which is a method for basically passing errors or requests to close the connection back and forth. And there's the application data. That's where the bulk data transfer occurs. So with the handshake messages, there's about 10 different types of them, which is it's a lot. So it comprises maybe half of the protocol specification. So all the handshake messages, so this header is in addition to the record header because the messages go inside the record. So the handshake message starts with a header with the type of the message, so the type of handshake it is, and then the number of bytes. And now I'm going to quickly run through all the different types of handshake messages, because this is really the heart of the protocol. So it's a bit long and tedious, but I tried to cut out most of the cruft. So the first one is the hello request, which is actually not used very often. This is sent by the server if it wants the client to initiate a renegotiation of the session. So this typically occurs if you have a very, very long session and you want to renegotiate the keys for some reason, like because the session's been going and you're concerned that the key might become vulnerable or they have too much data and they keep changing the key. It can be ignored by the other end or it can start the handshake. Usually the handshake starts with this message, which is sent by the client as soon as it connects. This is also the message it would send in response to the previous message, the hello request. So what's inside this? Some pretty important stuff. Firstly, the client version. Now, I mentioned briefly there's been three different versions of the protocol. So basically what it advertises is the highest version that it's able to support. It's sort of implicit that if you say you can support version 3.0, which is SSL v3, then you can also support version 2.0. And if you say you can support 3.1, which is TLS, then you can also support 3.0 and 2. So you advertise the highest version you're willing to support, which for most clients these days it would be 3.1. Then the client random, and this is a random number generated on the client server, on the client, and this will be used as part of the master secret calculation. But this message is generally sent in plain text. Certainly when you initialize an SSL connection, this is sent in plain text, so everyone can see this, so it's not secret. Then we have the session ID, which when a session is established, the server can issue the client with an ID. And if it presents that ID and the server recognizes it, then they can use an abbreviated handshake, which basically means they skip encrypting, and the client doesn't send the encrypted information encrypted with the RSA key. And this is because the decryption of that message is basically the slowest part of the handshake. So by skipping that, the handshake becomes a lot faster. And this is regarded as being quite important. You can imagine a situation where a client's connected, say, to an online shopping cart or something like this, and it's going to make a series of connections to the same server over the next, you know, 5-10 minutes. This is a big performance win for that. Okay, then after that's a cipher suite. So basically, a cipher suite encapsulates symmetric encryption algorithm, the hashing function that's going to be used in the Mac, the key exchange algorithm, basically defines the encryption, the cryptographic algorithm is going to be used. This is a list of cipher suites that the client is prepared to use. Usually in the order it will prefer them, although it's not really part of the standard, it's just sort of something people do. And then the list of compression methods, which will always be null because that's the only one there is. Okay, then the server replies with the server hello. And this looks pretty similar to the client hello. So it sends its version, and the server version will be the lowest of the highest version supported by the server and what the client advertised itself, which is, it's kind of logical. They just choose the highest one they can. It also includes a random number, which again, this message is plain text. So although this is used as part of the master secret calculation, this part is not secret. The session ID. If this session ID matches the session ID sent by the client, then they go to the abbreviated handshake. Else, it's a new session ID for the client they can use next time. It can also be empty, which means the server's not prepared to do the